This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
And I actually, I think I said, are you shooting at me? Like, that was a reasonable question.
We were removing the eyeball, and I remember I had taken the eye out, and I was holding it up and looking at it.
Black people are just such a strange people. And
so I began looking around, like inside my head, like I thought maybe I could see a light coming through a bullet hole or something.
Brain lesions, encephalitis, and just, it was a crazy, it was almost like everything went haywire.
Somebody who would lay in bed screaming all day long. And who, strangely enough, developed a fixation on Johnny Mathis.
And he looked at me and he said, I can't take you to the hospital, man. I have to kill you. And I said, oh, why is that, Ray?
Hello and welcome. We come to you from a world in the throes of death and poverty and toxicity. But here in Sebastopol, California, it's a very beautiful day. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller. And today the theme in our charting of journeys is, what we wound up with was Wounding and Healing, which we didn't think was the best title, but...
Actually, I was healed once, for free. Actually, and this was because my disease was so rare that I had value as a research patient. If not for that, I would not have had enough redeeming social importance to be saved or be here now. Funny life.
Well, actually, you did have to pay for your TV, but then that's how you discovered Monty Python, so it was worth it. We thought about calling it Finding the Music, which sounded too florid, but you'll find out why if you listen all the way to the last story, where a man talks about discovering jazz, finding the music, finding a reason to want healing in the first place.
Three stories today. What's it like to turn around and see that a man is about to kill you? What's it like to go from high-risk hitchhiker to Christian Science housewife to radical lesbian playwright in one life? And what is it like to find the music?
First story, Lion Goodman.
Lion Goodman lives in Mill Valley, California. He manufactures equipment for whitewater rafting, he was a corporate headhunter, and he's a spiritual teacher. He started his first company in college selling furniture and other equipment for meditation. He'd always been interested in consciousness and spirituality. That business failed, and he went on the road wholesaling jewelry and gift items. And that's where you might say that his consciousness expansion began. Oh, and well, a significant number of listeners I know don't remotely believe anyone who talks about a golden glow or sparks of light in the soul. So I guess you'll just have to wait till you're near death yourself and see if it happens to you. Meantime, enjoy the story.
One fateful day, I was on my way from Las Vegas to Los Angeles, and in the middle of the Mojave Desert, there was a car which had broken down and a man standing looking in the engine. And since it was about 110 degrees outside, I pulled over and said, you know, do you need any help? I'm heading into L.A. Do you want a ride? He said, sure, and he went and got his duffel bags and a backpack and a sleeping bag, and he brought it into my van, which was already full of samples and gift items and my own living supplies. And as soon as he got in the van, I started thinking, gee, I offered him a ride into L.A. I don't know when I'm going to get to L.A., and maybe I should just drop him off at the next reasonable city. But we began talking, and he rolled a joint, and we smoked a joint together, and I began to trust him a little bit more. And the next day, I actually sent him on errands with the van to get it gassed up while I was calling on stores selling my jewelry and gift items. And by the third day, we were kind of boon companions, and basically he became my assistant. He was young. He was younger than I was. I was 26 by this time, and he was probably in his early 20s. He looked pretty rough. He had some tattoos and was kind of scrawny. And I had kind of taken him under my wing. I was buying him food because he had no money and giving him things and giving him books to read and that kind of thing. And then I'd give him tasks to do, as an exchange, as a fair exchange. And the third night out, we were camped out in a place called Pudding Stone Reservoir, which is east of Claremont. And I was in the back of the van moving things around between some cabinets, trying to make more room for all the stuff that was in the van, which was just packed with my belongings and his now and all the sample cases. And he was up front in the van listening to music. And suddenly there was this explosion, this huge explosion that shook me, and I felt something hit me in the head. And my first thought was that the gas stove had exploded somehow. And I looked up and the gas stove was intact. And then I looked at him, and there he was in the front seat with his arm propped up with a black gun pointed at my head. And I realized that he had shot me. And I actually, I think I said, "Are you shooting at me?" Like that was a reasonable question. And he said, "Shut up." And my first instinct was, he's robbing me. He's going to rob me. He's going to take my stuff. And at that point, I would have been happy for him to dump me outside naked and take everything. And then he shot again. And I realized he's not warning me. He's going to kill me. And I'm a dead person because I was locked into a position where I couldn't defend myself. He was 11 feet away. His arm was propped up. The gun was pointed right at my head. And there was no way I was going to survive. So after realizing that I was a dead person, that I was about to be dead, I realized, okay, well, how do I want to die? And then I looked up to God and I said, okay, you know, I'm ready. I want to go to God. I don't want to go to some hurt place or some painful place or some leftover place from being incomplete. And he shot again for the third time. And again, my body shook with the explosion. And yet I wasn't hit by the second or the third bullets. And so I knew I didn't have much time left. And as I was expanding out with this golden glow, I was also focused on the spark of light that is at the center of myself. And that spark of light sort of started rising up above the van, and my sense of self was expanded out past the van. It was like a huge golden orb that I was at the center of and could see in all 360 directions. And I could look down in the van and see my body, see the position I was in, see him with the gun. And at this point, it was all kind of fascinating. It was like, wow, that's really interesting. And I was sort of raising my arms to Great Spirit and saying, okay, I'm ready to go, because I knew it was my time. It was time for me to be done in this body. And suddenly there was a fourth explosion. And the bullet, I could feel my head hit by the bullet. My head was thrown to the side because he was facing my left side. My left side was to him. And I could feel all this blood rushing down my head and dripping onto my shoulders and onto my thighs and down onto the floor. And I found myself back in my body. And so I began looking around, like inside my head, like I thought maybe I could see a light coming through a bullet hole or something. And I began tracking my own body and sensations. Nothing seemed to be missing. So I was strangely intact after being hit in the head with a bullet. And I decided to look my assassin in the eyes. And so I picked my head up, and I turned to my left and looked him in the eyes. And I could see him completely freak out. And he said, "Why aren't you dead, man? You're supposed to be dead!" And all I said was, "Here I am," because I had no idea why I wasn't dead. And then he said, "This is too weird. It's too weird. It's just like my dream. It's just like my dream." And I said, "What dream?" And he said, "My dream this morning, I dreamt that I was shooting at this guy and he wouldn't die, but it wasn't you, it was somebody else in the dream." And I thought, oh man, this is very weird. Like, who is writing this script? This is too strange. He'd shot me four times. Two of the bullets had hit me. And I figured if it was a revolver, he still had two bullets left. And if it was a semi-automatic, I didn't know how many bullets he had left. So I tried to speak to him, and I said, "Tell me more." And he said, "Shut up! Just shut up!" Well, we were out in the middle of nowhere. We were in this reservoir where, first of all, if somebody had heard a gun go off, they wouldn't have come anywhere near it. And secondly, there was probably no cars around for 20 miles. So I knew that there was no help to come, that all we had was myself, this light that was in me and him. So he began jumping around and sort of holding the gun nervously and looking out the windows, and my goal was to just keep calm him down. He was completely adrenalated from the shooting. So every time I tried to speak, he kept saying, "Shut up, just shut up." But he approached me with a gun in his hand, and he was looking at my head, and he was saying, "I shot you 4 times, man. How come you're not dead?" I found out later that he had actually been trained as a marksman in the Army, and that he was rated expert as a marksman. He was 11 or 12 feet away. His hand was on top of the back of the seat of the van, and there was no reason why I should not be dead. And he kept saying, "You know, why aren't you dead? Why were you so nice to me, man? Why were you so nice to me?" And I said, "Because you're a person, Ray." And he said, "Why were you so nice? All you kept being nice to me, and I couldn't decide when to shoot you." And I realized then that he had been planning this. And he told me later that he had taken the gun out many times during those 3 days and pointed it at me, but because I was being nice, he couldn't bring himself to do it. So he then said, "I don't know why you aren't dead, man. I shot you 4 times. And I said, "Maybe I'm not supposed to die." And he said, "Yeah, but I shot you." He says, "I don't know what to do now." And I said, "What do you want to do?" He said, "I wanted to kill you, man. I wanted to take this van and drive away. Now I don't know." I said, "Why did you want to kill me?" He said, "Because you had everything and I had nothing. I was tired of having nothing. It was my chance to have it all." And I realized that every person really wants to be listened to, you know. And so my job was to just be a listening for him, to really deeply listen to him and to draw him out. If he kept talking, he wouldn't shoot me again. So I said, "What do you want to do now, Ray?" And he said, "I don't know, man. Maybe I should take you to the hospital." So I said, "Okay, that's fine," because I wanted him to realize it was his idea, not mine. I didn't want him to feel like I was trying to gain control, because people get angry when they feel out of control. So at the same time that I felt very vulnerable, I also felt very powerful, like somehow I could control him. So after a couple more minutes, he said, "Okay, man, I'm going to take you to the hospital." And I said, "Okay." And there was blood all over the place, and I'm sure I looked a mess. But he said, "Now just stay there and be quiet, and don't die on me, okay?" I said, "Okay, Ray." And so I was very quiet. He got into the front seat of the van, turned on the engine, backed out of this dirt road we were on. I could feel the tires hitting the pavement and the van pulling forward. And, you know, we were off to a hospital or some unknown fate at that point. So I had about an hour to contemplate what had happened, how I had spent 3 days with this man, not even suspecting that he had any evil intent at all, and had been shot 4 times, and yet somehow I was intact and alive. I could feel this mat of blood and hair on the top of my head, and the blood slowed from a rush to a drip, 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 and finally it kind of stopped. And my head hurt like I'd been hit over the head with a bat, but other than that, I felt complete and intact. And so I had an hour to contemplate what had happened and to think over those 3 days. And eventually the van slowed and stopped and pulled over, and the engine was turned off. And he looked at me and he said, "I can't take you to the hospital, man. I have to kill you." And I said, "Oh, why is that, Ray?" He said, "You'll turn me in and they'll put me back in jail. I can't go back to jail, man." But I figured, okay, keep him talking. He does not really want to kill me. And I said, "Well, Ray, I could go to the hospital myself. You wouldn't even have to be there." "No, man, I wish I could trust you, but I can't. I can't trust you, man. You'd turn me in, I know they'd come after me." So I knew that my job was just to open up other possibilities, and that's what I did. I kept suggesting things, and he countered with why it wouldn't work, and I'd suggest something else, and he'd tell me why that wouldn't work. And the sky had turned from black to indigo, and then it began turning to blue, and I could hear birds singing. And it was the sweetest sound I had ever heard, because I thought I'd never hear birds singing again. And we were somewhere in LA, and we were near this embankment that led down to a small body of water like a pond. And he pointed with his gun down this trail that led to the pond. And so I began walking down the embankment toward the pond, and he was behind me with a gun. And I figured, okay, well, here's another opportunity. He could just shoot me in the back and push me into the water. But somehow I felt invulnerable. I felt like I had survived that. I could survive anything. So I walked down to the water, and I kneeled down, and I started washing the blood off my face and my hands, and finally stood up and looked at him. And at that point, he looked at me with a strange look in his eye, and he said, "What would you do if I handed you this gun?" And he sort of held it out to me a little bit. And I said the first thing that came to mind. I said, "I'd throw it out in the water there." And he looked at me very strangely, and he said, "You wouldn't try to kill me? You're not angry with me?" And I said, "No, Ray, why should I be angry? I've got my life and you've got yours." And he looked at me and he said, "Man, you are the weirdest person I have ever met." I just nodded. "Yep, I probably am. Maybe the weirdest person you'll ever meet." So I said, "Well, what now, Ray?" He said, "I don't know, man. I can't go back to jail, and I can't take you to the hospital." I said, "Well, let's talk about it some more." So we walked back up the embankment and sat in the van, and we talked. And I got him to tell me about his background. He had been raised in poverty in East L.A. His father had beat him when he was drunk. And so then he decided to join the Army to get out of the situation. But he couldn't handle the authority in the Army, so he went AWOL. And then he got involved in drugs and drug deals that went bad, and he ended up stealing money from the dealers and then getting in trouble and knowing he was going to be hunted down and killed probably. So he took his father's gun and some money, and he took off in his car. And then the car broke down in the Mojave Desert, and he just gave up. And he decided that he would kill whoever stopped for him. And I volunteered. So we began negotiating some more, and I kept bringing up more possibilities and tried to figure out what could we do. And we talked for hours as the day went on, as the morning came through, and we kept talking and figuring and calculating and negotiating. And finally, after many hours, we came to an agreement. The agreement was that I would not turn him in and that he would never do anything like that again. So we shook on it, and he drove to a place that he knew, and he parked, and I gave him what money I had, a couple $100, and some jewelry that I thought he could pawn, and he took his bags, and he walked out onto the street, and I walked with him, and he put down his bags, and I looked at him, and I shook his hand, and he looked at me with a very strange look in his face, and I said, "Goodbye, Ray." And he said, "Goodbye." And I walked back to my van, started the engine, drove myself to LA General Hospital. And I didn't go to the police because I had agreed not to. I kept my promise. And I believe Ray kept his. The clearest memory I have is that point of light that I was at the center of, an expanded ball of light where I could actually look down and see everything, as if looking down into a dollhouse. The dramatic part for me was how real it all was, that this is really what's happening. This really does happen. I really am here as a spark of light, not a body. I'm out of my body. Oh, well, that's sort of what you'd expect, to be out of your body. And seeing 360 degrees, that's what you'd expect. So the surprise was coming back into my body suddenly, to feel my head being pushed over by the bullet and to suddenly be fully embodied, from being outside my body to being fully embodied, and to feeling the pain and hearing the ringing in my ears. I remember feeling this sense of love for the guy. the love and the light that was pouring through me when I was out of my body didn't stop when I came back in my body. And I was in that light through the entire experience, all the way through being sewn up in the hospital. So it's like I was walking around a bit on a cloud filled with light. I imagine great saints have had the same experience of, you know, walking around like that all the time. For me, it was a bit unusual. I was very confused. Clearly, I had survived something traumatic, and I had had this traumatic experience of the light, but I didn't know what to do with it. And I was basically a hippie businessman trying to make it on the road, and one of my girlfriends came and took care of me for a couple of weeks. I was confused more than anything, and I said, "Okay, God, now what?" I got what I call the echo effect, which is when God returns your call and says, "Now what?" So I realized that God had given me all the clues I was going to get, that it was not a sudden, you know, it's like a burning bush that says, "Go forth and carve tablets" or something. This was just, okay, wake up. That was the message, wake up. And it was my job to figure out what to do with that. And frankly, I didn't know. And so I was trying to find a job in LA, and I ended up going to work for an employment agency. And that started a 22-year career in headhunting. Strange that I would become a headhunter after having my head hunted, don't you think? I had always considered myself intuitive and psychic. And after having been through that experience, I realized that not knowing that this guy had a gun pointed at my head numerous times through the 3-day period, having not a clue that he was thinking about shooting me, you'd think that that would be kind of obvious to a sensitive, intuitive, psychic person. And I realized I don't have a psychic bone in my body. This is, I can give that one up. People have asked, you know, do you still pick up hitchhikers? And I would say, yes, I do, but I'm a little bit more careful. I'm a little bit more sensitive. But I haven't lost my trust of people. Well, I have no fear of death. And it wasn't that I was afraid of death before, but having faced death and having been ready to die and been surrendered to dying and seeing that light and that love that's there, I have no fear of death. And then also it reinforced everything I had studied about my own spirituality and about spirituality in general. So it reinforced my desire to explore all aspects of consciousness, which I've continued to do for another 30 years. Here was a person that I didn't know. He was very different than me, grew up under completely different circumstances, was troubled and was, you know, a tortured soul, really. And yet I treated him as a full human being. He kept asking, "Why were you so nice to me, man?" And I didn't have an answer for that. It's just, I was on the road for a year and a half, and when you're on the road, you get kind of road warrior ethics. And for me, part of that ethic was you stop and help people. Their car broken down, tire needs to be changed. You're there on the road, and you know how rough the road can be, and so you begin kind to others. I don't know why the bullets didn't go into my head, except there was something that prevented him from actually carrying out his intention. He intended to kill me, and yet he couldn't. You never know who the person that you're looking at is or could be. So if you treat everyone as a divine being, then you'll never make a mistake. And when you're faced with death, and you're asked, "How am I going to die?" that also informs, "How am I going to live?" So if we ask those questions now, every day we wake up and we say, "How am I going to live today? How am I going to treat the person that delivers my newspaper or that hands me the receipt at the grocery store? How am I going to deal with the person that cuts me off in traffic?" You know, those are moment-by-moment decisions about how am I living? Am I living out of what I value, out of what I love? Or am I living out of my anger and my fear and driving myself into a dry, cold, and lonely place? So these are the questions that come when you're faced with death. I'm afraid of failure. I'm afraid of, my girlfriend would say I'm afraid of commitment. But that's not from that experience. It's from earlier things that I've been working on for 50 years. So, so sure, there's fear. But, I mean, what are the big fears? The big fears are death and commitment, you know. So, got one handled.
In Mill Valley, California, we were talking with Lion Goodman. Among many other things, Lion offers workshops, and you can find out about some of that at his website, everydayawakening.com.
This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.